It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the FDA granted full approval for a new Alzheimer's drug. We'll talk to a Wisconsin dementia expert about the potential benefits and risks of the treatment. First, a group of scientists this week says our planet Earth has entered a new human-caused epoch, the Anthropocene. That comes from an international working group of geologists that are recommending that the scientific community recognize the Anthropocene as beginning in the 1950s. If the Anthropocene Working Group's recommendation is taken up, this would be the first official geologic shift of its kind since the dawn of civilization, and the first that scientists say humanity sparked on its own. As a marker of the change, the group says the area around a lake in Canada shows a unique layer of plutonium from nuclear bomb tests and fly ash from burning fossil fuels. Our next guest teaches classes on the topic of the Anthropocene era, what it means, and how we define it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this concept that a human activity is causing a new era in the history of our planet? What would you like to know about people's impact on the planet? What do you want to see us do to adapt to a changing climate here on Earth? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Elizabeth Hennessy is an associate professor of history and environmental studies at UW-Madison. She teaches a class called Global Environmental History, How Do We Live in the Anthropocene? Elizabeth, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here, Rob. Thanks for having me.
This concept, this idea of the Anthropocene, it's been around for, I think, 20 years-ish or so now. I want to start, Elizabeth, with the significance, as you see it, of this group of scientists who are, I think, really thinking in the long term here, saying, yeah, we're entering into this new era. What do you make of what we're hearing from this Anthropocene working group?
Yeah, you're correct. They have been talking about this idea for about 20 years, and I think it really took off about 15 years ago. There's been a lot of scholarship on this Anthropocene idea, a lot of debate about it too. I think the big picture that the geologists have really pushed forward is that we have entered this human-caused epic, right? So right, we are in the Holocene right now and have been in the Holocene for the last 11,000, almost 12,000 years. And they're saying that in the 1950s, we have kind of reached a tipping point when all of the kind of, you know, the pollution, all of the kinds of things like climate change, species extinctions have pushed us into a new geological age in which we really see human impact on the world. And I think that this is, it's really significant because I think it's very much of our moment, kind of recognizing the impacts that humans have had on the world, but also in an environmental sense, thinking about, well, what do we do about this?
I think with geologists, part of the story here is that they're thinking, okay, our counterparts 10 million years from now, when they do core samples of the Earth, are they going to see a layer deposited that shows this big change? I think a lot of us are thinking in a shorter time horizon, Elizabeth. As you talk about exactly. The Anthropocene with your colleagues and students, what kind of things do you have your eye on?
It's a great question. The reason that they have found the 1950s to be this kind of starting point moment is because there are plutonium radioisotopes all around the world that have settled into, you know, the lake bed in this situation, but also on the floor of the ocean. And those have a half-life of something like 24,000 years. So 100,000 years from now, people will be able to still see those traces. And that's a really remarkable thing. And it's a really hard thing for us to get our heads around thinking about geological time spans. And so one of the issues that I think about with my students are, you know, like they're debating right now, is it going to be 1950? Is it going to be 1952? And from a geological standpoint, it's kind of a moot point because it's like saying, well, did it start on a Tuesday or a Wednesday? You know, like their geological time is so vast that a couple of years really isn't going to make a huge difference in what we see. And so when I talk with my students about the Anthropocene idea, we talk about more about the kinds of processes and the reasons why humans relate to our natural environments in the way that we do today and how those got started. What are those impacts? And trying to trace out those histories.
this concept of the Anthropocene, whatever the geologists end up seeing, saying about it, a lot of fields are working with this concept. What are some of the debates about, you know, whether we are in a new era shaped by human activity?
Yeah, well, there's been a huge amount of debate in the environmental humanities, which is my field. One of the biggest debates is about how we name this Anthropocene. And so there are a lot of different other potential names that have been tossed out there. There are folks who say, well, we should name it after the era of capitalism and call it the Capitalocene, in which case maybe it didn't start in 1950, but maybe it started 500 years ago with the advent of capitalism and the transatlantic slave trade. And so that pushes us then to think a little bit differently in terms of what is driving this new human age and what the main things we should be looking at are. So if you think about it as starting in the 1950s, historians call that the Great Acceleration. And so we see in the 1950s, this is the era when, you know, my grandparents and many others started having, everyone had electricity, phones, washer dryers, TVs, refrigerators. And so electricity usage went up. We all started driving cars. And so fossil fuel use has gone up dramatically. And so there's a lot that has happened in the mid 20th century besides all the nuclear test bombs that scientists are thinking about right now. But all of those processes that are being called out by geologists in the 1950s because they leave a really nice geological trace actually have a much longer history. And so that's something that historians, and I try to get my students to really think about, well, what are those longer histories and who is involved in this Anthropocene? Because one of the other debates about the word is that, you know, if it's the human age, then are we all in it in the same way, right? Is it all humanity that is to blame for this or at fault? Or is it different human groups, right? Different classes, people from different nationalities. And so there's a lot of debate about who's responsible for the Anthropocene.
Talking to Elizabeth Hennessy, Associate Professor of History and Environmental Studies at UW-Madison, looking at the Anthropocene, this idea that we are in a new era in the timeline of the Earth driven by human activity, human change, including climate change. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your reflections on that idea. What does that make you think about, worry about, maybe your questions on how we define this? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Lisa is with us in Madison. Lisa, hi.
Hi, you know, I guess it all makes sense to me. We can't have all this carbon buried under the Earth's surface for millions of years and then pumped into the atmosphere and not expect an impact. And I know people want to say that all of the climate change concerns are new, but I talked to your screener. I said I remember reading about an article from the early 1900s that expressed concerns about climate change. And when I was looking up a little while I was waiting, I came back to an article that talked about as early as 1824, a mathematician and physicist expressed concerns about or recognized that the atmosphere was warm, not just from the sun. And then in the mid-1800s, people started expressing concerns about climate change.
Lisa, thanks a lot for that call. And Elizabeth, I think if you run this idea to a lot of people about a new era driven by human activity, like Lisa, the first thing they might think of would be climate change and global warming. How does that fit into our conversation about the Anthropocene? I think we've, Elizabeth, are you still there?
I think we've, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Go ahead. Go for it. Oh, we're having some issues with our connection. Let's take a little break. Elizabeth Hennessy stays with us from UW-Madison. We're talking about the concept of the Anthropocene, new era in Earth's history, driven by changes caused by people. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What does that idea mean to you? We've got this geological working group saying, yeah, we recommend that, yes, officially, we are in a new epoch starting in the 1950s. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Lisa, thanks for calling in with those thoughts. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Elizabeth Hennessy, Associate Professor of History and Environmental Studies at UW-Madison, talking about a statement by an international working group of geologists this week saying the planet Earth is entering a new geological era caused by human activity and the wider concept of this Anthropocene. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Elizabeth, we heard from Lisa in Madison earlier, who brought up climate change as a central part of this story of a changing Earth driven by human activity. How central is climate change to this idea of the Anthropocene?
Yeah, Lisa's right. It's absolutely central to the idea of the Anthropocene. And I think that one of the things that the geologists are able to do is really kind of play up the significance of climate change and the fact that if we have tipped ourselves into a new geological epoch, those reverberations are going to be felt, you know, far, far into the future.
Lisa, thanks a lot for that call. Back to your calls now. Carl is with us in Shawano. Carl, hi.
Hello, sir. I'd like to ask your caller, what good's it going to do about climate change if the three biggest nations in the world have not signed the treaty, India, Russia, and China? Unless we all sign on, it's not going to do any good.
Carl, thanks for the call. Elizabeth, that takes us to, you know, okay, we're declaring ourselves in this new era, in part because of climate change. What kind of things can we do about it?
Yeah, well, he's right that the geologists are not politicians, and so they're calling attention to this only goes so far. And so there are a lot of critics who kind of push back and say, well, you know, we can call this era whatever we like, but the political questions are still very much on the table.
Carl, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Paul joins us now in Menominee. Paul, hi.
Hi. The biggest cause of most of these issues that we're talking about is overpopulation. Our population has tripled since the 1940s, human population. And unless we find a way to somehow encourage people to have small families, we are just going to eat away at all the life, animal life. We've already, half the animals have already gone extinct in the last 50 years. And so there's a lot needs to be done, and I don't know what kind of programs you could get people to get themselves involved in to have less children, but that's probably going to be the most effective thing you can do.
Paul, thanks for the call. Elizabeth, I know there's a lively debate over, you know, the number of people versus the resource consumption per capita, but one of Paul's main points there, he mentioned animal extinctions. I've talked to other guests who've talked about how we're in a new era of mass extinction. Is that one of the signs of the Anthropocene that you say in your class talk about with your students?
Yeah, exactly. We are in the so-called sixth mass extinction event. There have been five previous ones. And the last one was when the dinosaurs went extinct 65 million years ago. And that course was caused, we think, when an asteroid hit the Yucatan. But of course, we can't blame an asteroid for these more recent extinction events that are happening now. We haven't quite lost 50% yet, but people project that we will, over the course of this century, we could lose up to 75% of the current biodiversity in the world. So this is another one of the major things that the Anthropocene concept is calling attention to.
Thanks a lot for that call. Elizabeth, I mentioned your class title at the outset. I keep coming back to it. How do we live in the Anthropocene as part of it? And now this year we've seen unprecedented things like extended periods of wildfire smoke showing up here in Wisconsin, this vast heat wave spreading from border to border, basically, in the southern United States. What kind of questions do you have about how we live in the Anthropocene and how we adapt to this fundamental change?
Yeah, these are the really difficult and thorny questions that it's hard to have one answer, because if anyone did, we would be doing that, I think. And so this is something that my students and I spend a lot of time debating, because there are lots of different potential solutions on the table out there, things from geoengineering and thinking about how to shoot mirrors literally up into the sky to try and reflect back some of the sun's energy to slow down global warming. Things like seeding the ocean with iron to make it less acidic. And then, you know, we have also the other really interesting thing about the Anthropocene and this Crawford Lake designation of the kind of core area, which is up near Toronto, is that it's an Indigenous site. And so there are a lot of Indigenous scholars these days who are saying, you know, we've been living through these kind of apocalyptic times that many of us in the West are waking up to over the last 20 years. They've been living through that for centuries. And so looking to Indigenous scholars, Indigenous scientists to think about how to handle adaptation, how to handle what they call collective continuance is another major thing that I think we should be putting more attention on.
And that points to something you touched on earlier, the effects of this change, of climate change and other impacts of the Anthropocene, not evenly distributed among human societies, among individuals within the same society. What kind of questions does that raise?
Yeah, so that raises a lot of questions about, you know, who were the industrialized nations first? What were the motivations for industrialization? Who's profiting from that industrialization? You know, a lot of these things, most Americans are very much caught up in this kind of society. You know, I drive a car, I consume all of the electricity and whatnot that everyone else does. But how is it that we kind of reconcile our individual consumption with the profit motivation of many of the corporations that provide those services for us? So there's this issue within a nation, a developed nation like the United States, but then there are also really big gaps in the levels of consumption, both within the United States, but then also between what's often gets lost as the global North and the global South, right? So thinking about inequalities and different patterns of consumption in different among different communities around the globe too.
Talking to Elizabeth Hennessy, Associate Professor of History and Environmental Studies at UW-Madison, talking about a new era in Earth's timeline, the Anthropocene. Back to your calls now. Daryl is with us in Menominee Falls. Daryl, hi.
Hi. I would like to say that it seems in this country we live with such an adolescent mentality toward something. We don't want to be responsible for the way we live. People laugh off climate change. The scientists are trying to bring this up as a scam. I don't know what the scam is, what the scientists are gaining. They're trying to make us aware of what's actually going on in our environment. And that it's like we don't want to be responsible for the way we live. I would hope, I'm trying to be positive, I hope that we've had enough signs now with climate change and what's going on around us, that we start growing up and taking on responsibility for taking care of the planet we live in.
Daryl, thanks a lot for the call. Elizabeth, I want to key in on one phrase there. Daryl said, I try to be positive. As you talk to students about the Anthropocene and about climate change, things like that, people mostly presumably from a younger generation, what do you hear from them as far as the optimism versus doom scale of things?
This class that I teach has the potential to be very doom centric, but I really try to talk to them about activism, about the kind of choices that they make. And one of the reasons that I really like teaching history is that we can see through all these individual people's actions that have created historical change that things aren't inevitable. And so I think that if students have more of an understanding of how things have happened in the past, how individuals have made different decisions, then they, I hope, are inspired to feel like they also will have the power to make different decisions in the future, and that this isn't necessarily a death sentence for us. But it's certainly, I'm lucky that I teach young people and that they are, I think, inherently more optimistic.
Daryl, thanks a lot for that call. Elizabeth, we've got this idea, this label of the Anthropocene. How much does this label matter? How much does it, if we agree to say, yes, we're in a new era, yes, it's human caused, what, if anything, is the impact of doing that?
This is the big question. And I think that, you know, it can be in some ways a kind of academic pursuit role. Maybe we'll have a new geological era. And when our kids go through school, they'll learn that we're not in the Holocene anymore, but we're in this new Anthropocene era. And I think that has the potential to have people think differently about their relationships with the natural world. You know, a generation ago, we didn't think that people could have an outsized impact on the planet, which is why a lot of these, you know, these trends about mass production and mass consumption were happening, because we didn't think we were going, it would be possible to have the kind of impact that we have had. And so I think there is a general level of awareness that this will bring us. But beyond that, the political questions, I think, you know, as we were talking about before, they're still very much political questions that are not necessarily solved just because of this broader awareness.
Elizabeth, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
That's Elizabeth Hennessy, Associate Professor of History and Environmental Studies. She joined us for a look at the concept of the Anthropocene, a new era in Earth's timeline driven by changes caused by human activity. A working group in the geology scientific community recommended, yeah, we should call it the Anthropocene starting back in the 1950s. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a UW Alzheimer's researcher about a new FDA fully approved Alzheimer's drug that could slow the progression of the disease for many people in the early stages of the illness. Still questions, concerns about the impact of the medication, the cost, and possible side effects. We'll dig into that. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to a Second Amendment expert about a U.S. Supreme Court case that will decide whether people with domestic violence restraining orders are allowed to own guns. Now, the FDA gave its full approval last week to a new drug that can slow down the early onset of Alzheimer's disease. It's called Leqembi. It's the first new Alzheimer's drug to receive full FDA approval in two decades. Medicare says it will cover 80% of the cost of the drug, which costs as much as $26,000 a year. Also comes with risks of some serious side effects that it can include brain bleeding or swelling. Still, Leqembi is the first FDA-approved drug that shows signs of slowing the progression of Alzheimer's rather than just treating the symptoms. Our next guest researches Alzheimer's and has been watching these developments closely. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about this new Alzheimer's drug? If you or a loved one has been treated for Alzheimer's, what's your experience been like? What has gone well? What still needs to be better? What kind of research would you like to see? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Nate Chin is a geriatrician at the UW-Madison School of Medicine. He serves as medical director and clinical core co-leader for the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center and as medical director for the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention. He also hosts the podcast Dementia Matters. Dr. Chin, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Last time we talked to you about Leqembi, it wasn't as far along in the approval process. What does this full approval from the FDA mean?
Well, the full approval is a very big deal. It means that not only has this drug been approved to be used in the clinic, that Medicare will also now pay for most of it.
What does Leqembi do? How does it work?
So Leqembi is a monoclonal antibody. And that's a very technical way of saying it is a medication that goes into a person's vein. It is an antibody like one you would make if you had an infection yourself. This antibody goes into your brain and it attaches to this first protein of Alzheimer's disease called amyloid. It stimulates your own body to then attach to this protein, break it down, and clear it from the brain. So it, in essence, removes this first protein of Alzheimer's disease.
At what stage in Alzheimer's would someone use this medication?
Rob, that's one of the most important questions. It is really for earlier in the stage of thinking change and Alzheimer's disease. So people would have a clinical diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment or mild stage dementia. And the biggest difference between those two is that someone living with dementia has a functional day-to-day impairment. And it could be something like difficulty or unable to manage medications or finances, drive, cook, or clean. But there would be an impairment in that group of functions. And that would define mild stage. Moderate stage is not included in the indications for this drug. And that is someone who also has a basic activity of daily living that's impaired, something like dressing, bathing, or even walking.
That seems like a potential sticking point. How successful are we at catching Alzheimer's in that mild stage when, you know, maybe it seems like something little? It's not going to be the red flag that might even get somebody to the doctor's office.
You know, I would say Wisconsin's really good about continuing the message and raising awareness. And so in our clinics at UW Health, many people come in with mild cognitive impairment or are diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment or mild stage dementia. And I think that's because of the media and because of the message that's getting out to clinics and the public. There are certainly going to be individuals whose disease has progressed far enough along that we don't feel this medication is going to provide any meaningful benefit. And so those will be harder conversations, but certainly important ones.
Talking to Dr. Nate Chin from the UW-Madison School of Medicine and the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, looking at Leqembi. It's got full FDA approval for, as we just heard, mild stages of Alzheimer's. You could join in at 800-642-1234 if you have questions about this specific medication, other treatment and prevention questions you might have. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Chin, okay, we've got this patient with the diagnosis of mild Alzheimer's. What kind of benefits are we seeing in the testing process from Leqembi?
Well, what the clinical trial showed, and this is what the approval was based on, is that both the person with the disease and the person close to them, that we call them a study participant, they noticed a slowing in their thinking symptoms and their functional changes. And so these are validated questionnaires that were used at certain time points throughout this 18-month study. And so what people should expect is still having symptoms. This is not reversing change. It's not improving overall cognitive or functional ability or thinking ability. But over time, there is a slowing in what we anticipate to be a progressive condition.
How serious are our concerns about side effects with Leqembi?
I think they're very serious. I think it certainly has hit the media a lot. And so the most common side effect actually is an infusion reaction. And so think of lecanemab or Leqembi like chemotherapy. You are going into an infusion center where you're hooked up to an IV line and you're given this medication. And this happens twice a month. And when that happens, sometimes the body can have a response, whether that's fever or nausea or sweating. And so that was a common in about one-third of participants experienced that. It tended to go away after multiple visits, but that was common. The one I think most people are concerned about is the bleeding, the small bleeds that can happen in a person's brain. Of those that develop it, not everyone has symptoms. And so there's routine monitoring over the course of treatment with MRI scans to see if those things are present. And if so, a decision is going to be made whether or not you continue with the therapy or you stop it. Certainly those that have symptoms are likely to be the ones that would stop or hold for the time being.
And then there's the financial cost. I mentioned $26,000 a year, but as you mentioned, this full approval means Medicare covers 80% of that cost. Still can be pretty high for people. How worried are you that, you know, people who could benefit from this medication might face a financial barrier?
I think there's a lot of implications of this drug, including cost. So I certainly think that access is a major issue and that cost can be a barrier to it. I also think that healthcare is not necessarily ready as of this moment for this medication. The infrastructure is needed in order to properly do this. And what I mean by that is we need providers and staff and space to provide meaningful diagnosis, mild cognitive impairment, mild stage dementia. We need to go through the process of determining if this protein is present. We need to look for reversible causes. We need to make sure that people are functioning well. And then, of course, there is the infusion centers and making sure that people actually have access to the infusion center as well as the care that's needed afterwards. So it's a big lift for healthcare to be able to do this. We certainly want to be able to do it, but the cost as well as the cost of all the institutional needs, the infrastructure and the people is also going to be something that we're going to be facing.
That's an interesting point, Dr. Chin, that I got to say I haven't seen in a lot of the media coverage. What would be a timeline, a realistic timeline, to have that infrastructure in place to get this medication to people who might benefit from it?
I mean, that's a really good question. I'm sure every healthcare is asking themselves that. You know, at UW, we've been thinking about this for the past year, and so we have been working slowly to see what it would take and what is the staff, the space, the infusion centers, the care afterwards, the working with radiology, working with the emergency room. You know, what would this look like and what is needed? And I would say there's a big push to have this done sooner rather than later because we want to be able to offer this to those that would most benefit. And so it's probably going to be months before a person or a system would be able to do this on a routine basis. But I think it just reaches a bigger question for the country. You know, what is it that we need to focus on? And certainly we need to have better ways of diagnosing people, better ways of talking to people about the disease and the course, and still supporting them, regardless of the medication, making sure they're cared for, making sure the families are supported, because this disease is still going to continue even with the medication.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Stella is with us in Sturgeon Bay. Stella, hi.
Hi. My question is, Alzheimer's is but one of many, many kinds of dementia. And in the early stages of dementia, it's extremely difficult to diagnose what type of dementia one has. So my question is, given the severity and the seriousness of the potential side effects, is amyloid the cause of all dementias or of Alzheimer's specifically? And what is the risk of administering this medication and its potential side effects to somebody who has early stage dementia that is not Alzheimer's?
Wow. Stella, a great question. Dr. Chin.
Yeah, that is very thoughtful. I appreciate that question, Stella. First of all, there are many different causes of thinking change, including dementia, and Stella alluded to this. There's vascular disease, Parkinson's disease, Lewy body disease, a different protein called TDP43. And so Alzheimer's is specific to the presence of two proteins, amyloid, the first one, and the second one being tau. Tau is not as specific, but to one of your questions, Stella, amyloid is relatively specific to Alzheimer's disease. So if a person has mild cognitive impairment or mild stage dementia and they have elevated amyloid levels, we feel fairly confident, or I would say we feel confident, that Alzheimer's disease is a part of that process. Now, the complex part of this is there could be other diseases present too. You could also have vascular disease as well as your Alzheimer's. And this drug is not going to address any of those others. So if you end up being diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment or dementia, you would need a test to confirm that you have this protein in your brain. Right now, that would be a lumbar puncture or an amyloid PET scan, and we have yet to determine which is going to be covered by Medicare, but that would be one of two ways. Hopefully, we'll eventually have a blood test, which is certainly going to happen soon, but you'd have to have that protein. And if you don't have that protein, then you still have mild cognitive impairment or mild stage dementia, but there's another cause, one that either has not been identified yet or is about to be identified through a different test. And this drug is not going to be helpful. And no one should be on this medication if they don't have elevated amyloid in their brain.
Thanks a lot for that question, Stella. We're talking to UW Health geriatrician Dr. Nate Chin about Leqembi, a new Alzheimer's drug that received full FDA approval and could slow the progression of the disease, and other issues in dementia diagnosis, treatment, maybe prevention. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been watching the progress of this medication? Are you hopeful it can make a difference in Alzheimer's treatment? What questions do you have either about this specific medication or other things related to treatment and prevention of Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Dr. Nate Chin, geriatrician at UW Health, medical director for the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center and the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention. He's with us today to share what we know about a new Alzheimer's drug called Leqembi. It just received full FDA approval, shows potential for slowing down the progression of the disease for people with mild Alzheimer's. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How has Alzheimer's or another form of dementia impacted your life, the life of a loved one? What questions do you have about the benefits or risks of this new medication? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Chin, I wanted to ask about the work you're doing at the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention. A lot of research on this topic going on here in the state.
Well, the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention Study, the RAP study, is really one of the most internationally well-known. It's one of the longest running for people at risk for developing Alzheimer's disease. And so one of the key things that we need to recognize is that it has taken a while for science to be able to identify this protein, amyloid protein, in the brain of living people. And for the longest time, we were relying on autopsies, people passing away, in order to do this. And so because of studies like RAP and because of participants from this great state willing to come in and be tested, undergo lumbar punctures and PET scans, we've really been at the front in validating and showing that we can actually identify this protein. And once you identify it reliably, then things like these medications can be tested to see if they can actually get in there and remove it. And so really, it's the RAP study in our Alzheimer's Disease Research Center that really push forward the science of identifying these proteins and then trying to understand, what about our lifestyle? What about our social determinants of health, our backgrounds, our lived experience? What about those things as they affect these proteins in the brain?
Do we have a sense of, you know, lifestyle changes we can make, or society-wide changes we can make for that matter, that would help at least lower the risk of developing Alzheimer's?
Well, Rob, that's a great question. Kind of loaded, too. I would say at the individual level, yes, there's certainly things that we could do right now. We could focus on our sleep. Our culture doesn't tend to favor sleep, and I certainly believe we need 7 to 9 hours of good quality sleep. Being physically active, being mentally active, feeling supported, being social, these are things that are really important, and our science shows has a meaningful impact to thinking ability. It may not necessarily impact this protein of amyloid, but it's certainly important to how our brain performs and certainly important to how we feel overall with our well-being. From a societal level, Rob, you know, we need more access. People in underserved, underreached communities, they need to be able to get into safe spaces. They need to be able to exercise. They need to be able to reach healthy foods, the providers that they need. They need to have the things that have not been available that we know can contribute to thinking change, even things like proper education or good education. Those are things that can impact the brain that as a society, we certainly can invest and should invest our energy into.
I bring up prevention because it seems like treatment is a really hard target. It takes a long time to develop these drugs. They have some, but we don't have miracle cures yet. We've had other medications kind of fall by the wayside. What is it about Alzheimer's that makes, at least so far, that makes treatment so difficult?
Well, I think it's because many different things are likely happening that lead to the development of this first protein of amyloid. There's other things that are happening that lead to the development of the second protein called tau. And there's just other factors within the cells themselves or within the body that are impacting the brain. And so we really understand about 50% of later life changes in the brain. And so the science is really trying to pick up and understand what's happening to the brain, what's causing the things such as Alzheimer's Alzheimer's disease or Lewy body disease. And then only once we have a good understanding of that, do we bring in interventions of how can we impact this. And so it's taken a long time. And I would say partly it's because we needed the technology to identify the protein, but we needed the energy and the funding from the government to be able to look at a deep level at our brains itself. And certainly we're reaching that point now as far as the NIH funding great research.
Talking to Dr. Nate Chin with the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, talking about Alzheimer's disease, a new medication, Leqembi, approved, fully approved by the FDA for people at mild stages of the illness. It's still time for you to join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Chin, as we look at the approval of Leqembi, are you hopeful that, you know, this could point the way toward future treatments, that this might be, you know, not the end of this this thread of research, but could point toward better treatments in the future?
Absolutely, Rob. I really do see this as the beginning of a new time in Alzheimer's disease research and care and therapeutics. I think this drug is one of many to come out in the next few years. I think it is successful at removing amyloid, but we also have to think about other factors in the brain like tau, like insulin levels, like oxidation, inflammation. And I think we're going to have multiple therapies often used in combination to treat Alzheimer's in the end. And so I think of this as the beginning of what the time was like with HIV therapy. You know, you start with one, you then build upon that, and eventually you make this disease a chronic disease that people can continue to live well with. And certainly you can in the earlier parts of this. So I think the landscape has changed with this. More research will be needed, and certainly we're at a forefront for that. But I think things will get better going forward.
As Leqembi starts to get out into the market, and as you said, the infrastructure develops to provide it to people, what kind of research then happens to see, okay, now the public is using this outside of these organized trials to see what more we can learn from it?
Well, I think one of the easiest answers to that is we need to know what this medication does in people from other communities. The primary community for these trials were white individuals, mostly from urban cities. And so we really need to know our underrepresented groups, things like people like African Americans, Native Americans, Latino Americans, Hmong Americans. What does it look like in people of color? Is this the same impact? If you have different lifestyle or risk factors, how do those play into the progression of the disease? Even other brain diseases like vascular disease in the brain or Lewy body disease in the brain, when you have multiple, what does it look like when you have therapies like this? And so I think there are a lot more questions than there are answers right now. And so this is going to stem a lot more research with this drug being available to the public.
I want to spend a couple of minutes, Dr. Chin, with some practical advice for people. I think it's probably a common question for individuals as we age or as we watch loved ones age to think, you know, what are the warning signs? What are the signs that I should seek a diagnosis to see if I have some form of dementia? What kind of things should motivate people to get that checked out?
Well, I would say even earlier dementia, what are the warning signs of mild cognitive impairment, the stage beforehand? If people feel like they're having persistent symptoms, whether it is forgetfulness, repeating themselves, losing their train of thought more often, struggling to find words that is persistent and not just periodically, those are things that I would say, talk to the people you trust, ask them, do you notice this? Is it just me or are you seeing it? Then talk to your primary care provider because you can be evaluated with a brief cognitive screen, not a diagnosis, but a screen to see how is your brain performing. And from there, we really do look for reversible causes of your symptoms. Not everything is Alzheimer's disease. And in fact, many things are reversible, like the medications you're on, perhaps they're causing it, or your depression, or your sleep apnea, or your thyroid, or vitamin deficiencies. The thing that I think people really need to realize is that there's a lot we can do. This idea that, oh, you know, it's Alzheimer's and we're done, that's changing, not only with this drug, but with what we can do in clinic. If people go in and get evaluated, I think they'll find it more rewarding and less fearful than they initially thought.
Dr. Chin, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
That's Dr. Nate Chin, geriatrician at the UW-Madison School of Medicine. He serves as medical director and clinical core co-leader for the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center and medical director for the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention. You can also catch him on the podcast Dementia Matters. He was with us today to talk us through the potential benefits and risks of a new Alzheimer's drug called Leqembi, which received full FDA approval that came last week.